The following program is brought to you by Firefly Willows, LIVE.
Hi, I'm Carrie Lake.
Hi, I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. Hi, I'm John Carosella, your host for A Shamanic Life, here on Firefly Willows, LIVE. We have a great show for you tonight. I'm actually sharing this with you from Daytona Beach, Florida. The ocean behind me is beckoning, the surf seductive, and the water is delightfully warm. Much different from the Pacific Ocean over in Aptos, where I currently call. I'm taking a little quiet time after selling our house. That's a major shift, and bringing that exercise to a contented conclusion was important, though filled with tears for the goodbye that had to be said. There's still more to come for me. I sense this is so for many of you, too. Times are changing, and our lives, our purpose, must unfold. To quote Anais Nin, there came a time when the risk to remain tight in the bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom. That time may be now, for you and for me. We've got a great show again today. You'll hear from Carrie Lake, author of Listen Like a Horse, Relationships Without Dominance. And whether you're a horse person or not, whether you've had experiences with horses or not, Carrie has much to teach us and much to share. I was amazed and delighted with our conversation and with the enhanced sensory and intuitive perception that Carrie guided me to. Check it out. You won't be disappointed. And in spirit, muse, and song, I'm in conversation with Sue Ellen Primost, a multi-talented performer, improvist, and master of the cello. Her music is moving, captivating and soothing, strange and enchanting, and she's pretty cool too. She takes the cello to places unexpected and delightful. I know you'll enjoy her thoughts and her music. I'm thinking that Karen and I will be back in conversation next time on October 15th for our next edition of A Shamanic Life. But I thought that last time too, and it just seems that my life has its own twists and turns in store for me. So, just stay tuned. It's crazy, it's unpredictable, it's unconventional. I guess you could say, it's a shamanic life. And before we lead into the show, I just wanted to remind you that I'm now a regular over at East West Books in Mountain View, California. I'm offering rune, oracle, and tarot readings from noon till 7 every Friday. Except this one, of course, because I'm on vacation. And I'm also available for shamanic healing work as well. If you're local, come by and say hello. Mention A Shamanic Life, and I'll be so delighted you'll get 10% off. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
At Firefly Willows, LIVE, we're working hard to be your trusted source for fun, enlightening, and heart-centered information and community. And we're passionate about the art of transformative media, the new leading edge of communication in our highly connected, media-rich world. If you're passionate about facilitating change and you have gifts or ideas you'd like to share, come join us. Host a show or be a guest or connect us to an amazing speaker or teacher whose message is too good to miss. There's always room for courageous, knowledgeable changemakers, inspired artists, and new ideas. Let us know you're interested. Send an email to info@fireflywillows.com. We're Firefly Willows, LIVE, helping you find and shine your inner light.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. And with me for today's featured guest interview is Carrie Lake. Writer and facilitator Carrie Lake communicates from a perspective of equality among all species and dimensions, a kind of creator consciousness, inviting the absence of judgment and the fullest embodiment of divine essence. Through one-on-one sessions, group events, and speaking, she shares tools and awareness and articulates subtle yet profound aspects of consciousness with humor, lightness, and truth. She is the author of two books, including Listen Like a Horse, Relationships Without Dominance, and she serves to assist and guide your creative fruition, awareness, and success to reclaim your birthright as creator incarnate. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, John. It's such an honor to be here playing with you.
I have to tell you, your book, I just caught the title, and Listen Like a Horse, Relationships Without Dominance. was such a profound statement about how we unconsciously project dominance into relationships, and how horses are like a perfect example of when we're doing that and why it's not good, and what you can learn from them. I was powerfully moved by the title.
Oh, thank you.
And then I read right in the beginning, you're kind of like your introduction to the book. This is an invitation to greater kindness. We have been taught to use dominance with animals in our own thoughts, actions, and choices. This book will assist you to recognize and transcend patterns of dominance and force in relationships. And I was like, okay, this is really important work. By allowing yourself the awareness and exploration, you will be activating your natural state of being, which is absent of judgment and free to receive and express the love, abundance, health, and wellness that is your birthright. And I was like, I was hooked. I'm totally like, I haven't had the chance to read the whole thing, but
yeah.
I read through as much of it as I could. And I think there's really powerful messages in here that starts with judgment and how judgment takes us into weird places.
Mm.
So share a little bit about that, about how you came to this awareness. I mean, we're going to talk all about your past and background, but
sure.
Let's start with that.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's actually the horses that brought me to that awareness when I started to ask them, how do you do it? How do you keep giving to people when they don't see you, they don't hear you, and you just keep giving? And the sense of what they shared with me, just from heart connection and awareness and in consciousness, it got distilled into these words, absence of judgment. And in my own journey through life, trying to see, why are things repeating in my life? Why do I keep coming up on the same walls? Why does it keep being so difficult? And when I think it should be easy. So in the assistance that I receive, it was brought to my attention. I started using these words, absence of judgment, because that's what the horses are, the space that they are. They have no judgment. They show up and say, okay, well, that's what's going on. And here's me in this environment. Sometimes it's pretty, sometimes it's not pretty. But they're not judging. They're not saying, this is a wrong way to train me. They're saying, okay, you can do this, but here's how it looks when you do.
Right. Consequent actions and consequences.
Yes. To me, it's more communication rather than a one-to-one linear progression of, if you do this, then this happens. It's more of a communication of, okay, I see who you are. The actions you're doing are not consistent with who you are. So here's my response.
Do they, some of what I read seem to indicate that they sort of take you at face value.
Absolutely.
And they integrate your behavior into a model of communication that is accurate if you have no judgment.
It's very, very clear and pristine when there's no judgment. As if letting go of judgment in with the horses can look like not taking it personally.
And not taking it personally. I actually have that noted down.
Yeah.
This is one of the things, the most powerful aspects of the Four Agreements, Don Miguel Ruiz. Mm-hmm. One of his agreements is don't take anything personally.
Yeah.
And I saw that correlation in what you were talking about. It's like, if you don't take it personally and just take it as a system of a feedback system,
yes,
where you're projecting a message and they're responding and they're projecting a message and you're responding,
yes,
without judgment,
yes,
and it's not personal.
Yes.
It's just what's happening.
Yes. Yes. And from there, we get to play with, okay, well, how do we really want this to feel? Are we here to play with one another? Are we here to battle and prove that my techniques are the right way and you should be doing it the way I think you should be doing it? Well, the horses will always go, okay, as you wish, but here's what it feels like to be me when you do that.
emphasis from the horses who are around.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it feels like to be me when you do that. And I think that's, it's so easy to be confused, because what we want is for our judgment to be the dominant factor in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And when the other party doesn't respond to the notion of judgment, we're basically living in a fantasy world.
Yeah, working really, really hard to try to find proof for what we think should be happening. So, for example, if I think the horse is supposed to lift his foot when I ask for it and all of a sudden he doesn't, I can perhaps go into a thought pattern of, well, that's bad. And he should be lifting his foot. So if that's bad, then there's something wrong. Am I doing it right? Yes or no? Well, I've decided I'm doing it right. Therefore, the horse is wrong. So the horse needs to change. And within all of that, all of those rightses and wrongses bring us to a place of having to prove it's right or wrong by pushing harder or some, in one way or another, dominating the situation either physically with physical actions. Sometimes people will pick up a stick and hit a horse, and
right,
that's
right.
A huge dominant behavior.
Right.
Nothing wrong with it. It just is hitting a horse with a stick, and the horse is going to respond and, by recognizing that you are a human who's willing to behave that way and hit them
right.
with a stick.
Right.
Okay, great. Well, then here's how I'll respond to you. Maybe it will be fear. Maybe it will be throwing a hip in retaliation. Maybe it will be walking away. Maybe it will be greater resistance. But the awareness and the clarity and really the relief from all of that comes when we sort of take a breath and look at how that entire situation feels, because that's just a huge series of communications. When we stop and bring our attention away from trying to manipulate the behaviors and get the horse to behave this way and me to behave that way, if we instead look within our own body and at our solar plexus and our heart and say, how is this feeling? What is actually the communication going on here? Is this expansive and inviting more communication? Or is my gut, my solar plexus getting tight and shutting down? Am I in a cycle of defending my rightness?
Yeah. You know, I had one of the most powerful statements that has affected my perception as an adult came from a colleague of mine. We were talking about raising children, and she was relating how when she was raising her teenage daughter, you know, there was all the drama and all the power struggles and all
right.
that kind of stuff. And at some point, she said, at some point I had to decide, did I want to be right or did I want to be effective?
Exactly.
And wow, that just blew open a whole set of doors for me.
Yeah.
About judging or demanding that I be right instead of looking at the situation and asking, what's happening and what is my role in it?
Mm-hmm.
And am I really cultivating what I want?
Mm-hmm.
Because letting go of being right, why is that hard?
Oh, gosh, it's funny. It's one of the hardest things for people to do. And how much were we conditioned that right is good? Being right is a good way to be. You go to school, you get the right answers, you get a gold star, and people celebrate it. If you get it wrong, you have to go back and try again until you're right. It's conditioned into our mental structures in social awareness. And it does come down to being dominant. And that dominating something is good. Dominating a market, dominating just you're having a dominant presence.
Dominating is good.
That's
a really profound statement. We're programmed.
Yes.
To feel that dominating, to perceive that dominating something is good.
And in our perceptions, we've found proof of it in nature. So this is the nature of judgment, okay? When we decide that dominating is good, then we're going to look around and find proof for that. Science and biology and all sorts of studies have gone out and watched animals in nature. And they watch one animal push others around, claim space, and therefore eat first, for example. And that gets assigned the word dominant. That becomes what we call dominant behavior because they eat first. Well, that seems to perpetuate that individual's survival, which again is called good.
Right.
Then now we have correlation that dominance is good. And that means that that animal is going to survive longer. Survival is good. So let's emulate that and let's look for patterns of dominance. You know, how do we dominate while still being in harmony with nature? Because we've now seen that dominance is in harmony with nature. And so it's this cycle of dominance is good. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just one way to walk through life. And I just see it differently. And in my interactions with the animals and with people, that it's not necessary, when one horse pushes another horse off of their food, it's not necessarily dominance. It's one horse saying, this is who I am, I'm going to eat before you, get out of my way. And the other horse says, oh, I acknowledge who you are, this is who I am, I'm going to move.
So that's a really subtle distinction. That's a really subtle difference. I wonder if you can tease that out a little bit more, because it feels like it fits the description of dominance that we have when we define the word or intend something with the word dominance.
Yeah.
How is it different for horses?
Well, the concept is different because it takes away good and bad and right and wrong. It takes away that being the first to eat is good, and instead points at, I'm eating first because it's who I am. This is my natural expression. And I'm willing to show up and embody my natural expression. We can still use the word dominant and say that that is dominant behavior. But I'm just pointing to the awareness that that is a word that we have put on it. It's not like the horses are going around saying, I'm dominant, therefore this is what I do. Horses are going around saying, well, this is who I am. I think I'll eat first. Get out of my way. Another example is in a herd, there are many mares, many females. And there are leaders, lead mares, and there are many that are not. The ones that are lead mares lead in various different ways, some of them with aggressive behavior, some of them with very passive leadership behavior, just leading by example. But the ones who are very embodied and comfortable with who they are without having to try to prove where they belong in the herd. They just, this is who I am. I'm a lead mare. I lead like this. Everybody come with me. Then it's effortless to follow that individual because she emanates and communicates a sense of, this is who I am. This is what's happening next. It's just natural for me to communicate this and play this role, so let's go. She's not questioning who she is or whether she's doing it the right way.
Or whether she's supposed to do it.
Exactly.
Or whether it's right.
Exactly.
For her to do it. She's just doing it.
Exactly. So take that back to the feeding example and the horse who says, I'm eating first, just by nature, because that's who I am, they're just doing it.
It's fascinating. So that leads us to a whole bunch of things that I want to pull out of your book. One is that you said an organic reality happens without trying. It's what life looks like when we stop trying to be something and stop trying to avoid being something. And so you just described the nature of that behavior in the lead mare. How does that, what advice do you have for us humans?
Yeah. It's such a beautiful gift to give ourselves to start to become aware of when we're being right or when we've decided we're being wrong, because simply that awareness gives us the space to just be who we are without trying to be right, without trying to avoid being wrong, if right and wrong are good and bad. In that situation.
Right.
And each of us has that unique essence. That's who we are. Each of us has a unique tone and expression that is who we are. When people say, shine your light is like no other light on the planet. You're unique, and that's why you came here. That's what I'm referring to. And when we give ourselves that gift of awareness without judging ourselves, oh, I was trying to be right again, that's bad. Okay.
It's even there.
It's judging. Exactly. And not, you know, and then you could go on with it and say, oh, I just judged myself and that's bad.
Right.
And I shouldn't be judging myself. And then I'm sorry I'm judging myself. All of that is working really, really, really hard to fit into somebody else's idea of how to be who you are.
And so what happens when we let go of that? Or what's hard about letting go of that?
Well, how much have we also been taught that we require approval?
Yeah, okay. So a big part of it is approval, either, you know, the judge or the critic or you know, that voice in our heads that says, this is who I should be,
mm-hmm.
or this is what is appealing or acceptable or... socially connected. It allows me to stay socially connected to my tribe or whatever.
Yes. Yes. Because heaven forbid you would be different enough to be misunderstood when you walk your own path. And so many of us are, but it's not very easily accessible to just claim our uniqueness and our difference, speak the way we speak, and risk being misunderstood and having that sensation of being set apart.
Yeah, being set apart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a scary and uncomfortable feeling. And there's another scary and uncomfortable feeling that relates back to dominance,
yes.
Which I want, you know, and again, I want to keep coming back to this because relationships without dominance is such a powerful three words. It's really powerful to imagine a world where we have relationships without dominance and teasing that apart. You said something that I thought was really profound. Humans, when faced with embarrassment or a loss of control, will often go straight into dominance by whatever means necessary. When faced with embarrassment or loss of control, straight into dominance by whatever means necessary. I can't imagine a more succinct description of the torment that we are experiencing in our world, the conflict, the nature of the conflicts that we're experiencing in our world, our politics,
yeah.
Our religious wars.
Yeah.
It's like straight to dominance.
Yes.
What do we do about that?
Oh, wow.
And no pressure. I'm just expecting you to solve the,
yeah.
the planetary problems.
To me, it all comes back to having the kindness and the grace to listen to the battles going on inside of us first.
Mm-hmm.
Because often the very first wave of dominance is in dominating our own thoughts.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because
mm-hmm.
it's, I want to be right, and I don't want to be seen as being this way.
Mm-hmm.
I need to defend something. I need to justify something
mm-hmm.
so that other people won't see me a certain way.
Because
mm-hmm. that could be embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm not in control of my image. I'm not in control of my persona.
Exactly. And who knows what people will see in me and what they'll see that I'm not even aware of, and then I can't defend it for sure because I didn't even know it was there. So at least I'll be safe if I show you what I think I want you to see and just deal with it. And so I think the first place to play with all of that is, what if dominance is okay? What if we just let dominance be dominance. Not that we have to get rid of it. Not that it's the enemy.
Okay. That's a left turn in this conversation.
Yeah.
Share more about that.
Yes.
So, I mean, if dominance is okay, then what?
If dominance is okay, then we're free to see it when it's happening. And we're free to step out of being controlled by it.
If dominance is okay, we're free to call it out.
Yeah.
We don't have to, so do we not call it out? I mean, is that sort of systematic self-delusion that we don't call out when we're trying to be dominant?
Yeah. It's part of that difficulty of giving up being right. Because if dominance is a really great tool to protect us from embarrassment or loss of control, and being in control is a good thing, then there's really no reason to become really aware of being dominant and how it's affecting our world. And it can be really scary to call ourselves out and go, oh, there I was dominating my own thoughts again. Oh my goodness. It can be very tender to be that vulnerable to ourselves.
Huh. So it's not that dominance is good.
Mm-hmm.
It's that seeing dominance for what it is, it is to be encouraged.
It's a fun place to play, and it can be an intense ride on a sensory level because it can bring up those uncomfortable sensations that we would call embarrassment or fear or the unknown.
But so if we call ourselves on our own dominance,
mm-hmm.
then we have a place to say, do I want to be dominant?
Exactly.
Is that what I want to exhibit? Is that who I want to be in this moment?
Or is that who I really am? Going back to that organic reality description, when we stop trying to be something and stop trying to avoid being something, then our essence can just emanate unadulterated.
Wow. Okay. So this is really fantastic material. I want to take a short break and we'll be back and we're going to talk some more with Carrie Lake. We'll be right back.
We hope you're enjoying today's program. You can find archives of A Shamanic Life and our other thoughtful and provocative programs at blogtalkradio.com/fireflywillowslive. Check out Convergence, John's monthly radio magazine where science and mysticism meet, the third Sunday of every month, or one of our other interesting shows and their interesting hosts. blogtalkradio.com/fireflywillowslive. Come join us.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. And with me in conversation is Carrie Lake, author of Listen Like a Horse, Relationships Without Dominance. And Carrie, before the break, we talked about a lot of things, including the nature of dominance and why it's embedded in our lives. And I want to talk a little bit about the work that you actually do with people with this awareness that you developed. And I want to draw our attention to that with another quote from the book. You wrote, energy responds to our awareness. We have the ability to create and recreate our outside world. Ultimately, then, the question comes down to our motivation. If we're going to create a change in the energy, what causes us to make that change? Is it coming from judgment or need? Is it coming from repetition of what we were taught by those who were unaware? Is it coming from the knowing of communion with our heart and all of life? So it sounds to me like the good place from which to make that change, if we want to make a change,
yeah.
is the place of communion with our heart. How do you get, do you help people find this place?
Yeah, absolutely. The fun part is none of those places is better than another. It's just going to affect the creation.
Ah, okay. So again, no judgment on where you're creating from,
right.
But awareness of where you're creating from is helpful in understanding how much work is involved and and the results that you get.
I would say beyond the results you get, the doors that'll open for you to step further. we can create from a familiar place because we've been taught that that's a safe way to go. And beyond that, we've been taught that's who you are. You like horses, you ride English, you live in suburbia, so you should also like shopping at a mall and buying a lot of things. So if that's who I think I am and I keep recreating from unconsciously from that place, the doors that'll open for me will lead me into more of the same.
Right, right. And this is again, this is like Don Miguel Ruiz talking about these agreements that we have made that bind us to our culture and our history and our family and our personal experience.
Yeah, that we're aware of or not aware of. And again, is not good or bad. It's just who we've been taught to think we are.
Mm.
Coming into the sense of communion with all of life is really stepping into the unknown and saying, okay, if there's something that is bigger than what I know, and if that something that is bigger than what I know is already connected with all of life, and we're all here creating together, I want to know what doors open when I let my creation happen from that place.
And what is that place like?
Unique to everybody, because everybody will have their own sensory experience of it. And guiding people there is a journey of really just asking the mind who it thinks it is and coming to a truth of, well, is that true or is that what we've been taught to think about ourselves? That place is a sensory experience. To me, the words that I like to use is truth is a sensory experience. It's a vibration that we know when it's moving through us. And when we let our words and our actions be distilled from that place, as opposed to looking at what options are in front of us and choosing from what we see on the outside, instead we come into awareness of that vibration moving through our own body and then ask, just in conversation with that aspect of ourselves, our own divinity, where will we go next if we're creating from that vibration?
Well, that feels pretty awesome to me.
Yeah, new awareness comes that isn't based on multiple choice. New awareness comes that creates new doorways, new openings that may not be immediately recognizable from our past experience, that may not be what we think they should be. But being in awareness of that sense and that emanation and giving the go-ahead for creation to happen from that divine uniqueness of me, it's a paradigm shift for the mind to go through, but the body knows it innately. And all of the shifting on the planet, all the shifting in consciousness, everything's been pointing toward living from that communion within ourselves, because the communion with all that is already there.
So I talk about this in a slightly different way sometimes. It's not like we have to plant a whole bunch of things. We just have to weed the garden that we've got.
Mm.
You know, bring our awareness to what is.
Exactly.
Because it's already there.
Exactly. And when people want to expand their ability for communicating with their animals, or even there are some clients who show up and say, I can't feel anything. I know I should, but I don't feel anything. There's such gentleness and grace in assisting them to see where they actually are already feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the way they describe what they're feeling is nothing. Great. So what does nothing feel like?
Mm.
And then it's just part of the way that I assist, that in just going direct in consciousness, activating the aspects and vibrational aspects and dimensions of people that are really the ones knocking on the backs of the eyelids saying, okay, I'm ready for expression now.
Mm-hmm.
Activating that and then guiding the person in front of me to open their awareness to what their body is communicating, what their sensory experience is actually already communicating. it starts to broaden their own landscape of what's actually happening through their own body and awareness. It broadens their the possibility of what communication is.
Yes, I like that. Yeah.
And takes away the rules of what it should be, so that, you know, it's familiar, it's unfamiliar, that's great, but what is it that's in your perception right now? The very first thing that comes. And some people will call it a color. Some people will just go, ugh, like, perfect. Because that, I mean, that's a lifetime of communication right there.
Yeah, and I think there's a, again, it comes back to rightness mm-hmm. as a an impediment.
Mm.
Right? Like, if I have to be right, if I have to give you the right answer, then it doesn't get expressed.
Yes. Yes. And when the truth is, it's just the most beautiful moment in the world, because then we can address that and say, how's that working for you? Is that still the way that you'd like to continue forward now that you're aware of it? Because how many people go around feeling, ugh, but tuck it away so that they're not aware of it, because they're trying so desperately hard to do spirituality the right way, or do life the right way, or do work the right way, the way we've been taught.
Or do relationship the right way.
Exactly. The way we've been taught is successful, whatever success is.
Yeah. What is that?
Yeah. And what if we just let success be a unique expression for everybody, but you know it because you feel it, rather than waiting for the outside validation, gold star of what a boss might say, or that my partner smiles.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a very interesting contraction of the consciousness to the present moment. You know what I mean? It's like, instead of projecting forward mm-hmm. and backwards into story about mm-hmm. what should be happening, or about what's going to happen, or what I want to happen, it's a contraction of the moment of the consciousness into the present moment that says, this is what is right now, and what do I do about it?
Well, and the beautiful thing is, at the same time you're using the word contraction, I'd call it an expansion.
It is actually also an expansion.
What actually is right now, but with just this gentle grace of not deciding that anything that's happening now is the right thing or the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Or it should or shouldn't be happening.
Which expands
everything
gigantically, the available perceptual field.
Yes.
If you're not judging something, then it's almost like you allow more in.
Yes. And this is where I kind of wanted to just dive in a little to where people will talk about quieting the mind and getting the mind out of the way. And my question is, okay, how's that working? Because there's so many people who, they work at it. It becomes work to quiet the mind. And then when you're not actively quieting the mind, you still have the mind to deal with. So I say, bring it on. Okay, mind, what do you got for me? What's going on? And really listen the same way that I would listen to a little four-year-old human walking up and going, blah, 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 here's what's going on for me today. And I saw this and I saw that and this was bad. Did you see him? Great. So can I befriend my mind enough to listen, what do you got going on today? But also not be pulled into the stories.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. It's safe and acceptable, but it doesn't make it right.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make it wrong. It's just is.
Yeah, oh, the mind may show up and say, oh my God, did you see all the disapproval on that person's face? You got to change this. You got to buy a whole new wardrobe. You got to change jobs. You got to change the way you talk. You should get a haircut, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I can go, my beloved friend of mine, you're trying really hard to make it so that I don't feel discomfort. I appreciate that. And I hear all your suggestions, but no thank you.
No thank you. Which brings me to another thing that was, this, your book is so cool. This work with Cooper the horse is just so, so exciting to me. You were talking about this circumstance. I think it was you were trying to clean his foot or something. He tried to kick you.
Yeah.
And your response to that was to gather yourself in a very particular way. And this is what you wrote. In my presence and all of my being, I know beyond any shadow of a doubt that I am not available to be kicked.
Mm-hmm.
I become that vibration. I integrate that truth into my state of being. I'm simply not available to be kicked. This is a neutral statement that carries no emotional charge. No, thank you. Right?
Yeah.
How do you do that? Tell us something about that.
We have the capacity to use the tool of our imagination to remember a sensation of, say, happy. What did it feel like at your birthday party? Oh, I felt happy. And the whole body can shift and change. And the whole body can remember what the sensation of happy feels like. And another case in point, quick example that helps people understand sometimes is, consider if you're feeling great and relaxed and really good, and you open a door to walk into a room, and this room is full of angry people, and nobody says a word, but can you tell that they're angry? Does your body respond when you walk into a room of angry people? You can just sense the tone and the vibration of it. And likewise, if you're feeling great and you open the door and walk into a room full of happy people, is that going to feel the same or different than a room and full of the ambient energy of angry or happy?
Yeah.
So I started playing with that and going, why can't I just adjust my own field? What does happy feel like in every cell of my body, and why would I choose that? And that kind of exploration awakened me to our capacity to just tune our energy field for what's true. And
to some degree, we can determine what's true for us.
Absolutely. When we are very aware of what is true, what we're communicating, that can be called presence. When you are, it just is what's true for me. This is who I am in this circumstance. And so in that, with playing with Cooper and playing with horses and being unavailable for injury, is essentially like tuning my own system, tuning my own radio dial, so that that I can recall a sensation of no, I'm not injured. I won't be injured. And my body will move in any way that it needs to in response to the environment around me, so that I will not be injured. It's really stepping into communion with the present moment, giving the movements of my body over to a greater communication, so that if the horse's body moves, my body moves in a way that keeps me from being injured.
Mm-hmm.
It is truly being in conversation on multiple dimensions and multiple energetic levels. But I get to that place by acknowledging first, it's my natural birthright to play that way. Am I divinity or am I divinity? Show me what's accessible, because this has got to be pretty cool, right?
Right.
So it's first really welcoming that truth of who I am, and then playing with it and saying, what does it feel like to be totally unavailable to injury? And it means, it would mean giving up being right and having to enforce my rightness by saying, the horse is about to kick me, I have to resist it. Or correct it, or punish it, which is often what happens. Instead, it's showing up, knowing, there's no reason for me to be injured. So if you're feeling like you need to kick me, you just let me know energetically, I'll get out of the way. And we'll do it differently.
And that, I imagine, takes a certain amount of practice and cultivation?
I don't know. In my world, it is as easy as saying, show me what that feels like. And the practice and cultivation, I think, is more a factor of having awareness of when our thoughts, when the thoughts get dominant, to say, don't do it that way.
Oh,
you're not
right.
supposed to let that happen.
Right.
He's not allowed to get away with that. What is it? What does it say about you if the horse tries to kick you? What did you do wrong? So,
or what does it say about the horse's attitude or something?
Exactly. The horse's attitude, his training, is that horse trying to get one over on me? Get one over on me?
Right.
Did I just lose face? It goes back to the embarrassment.
Yeah, yeah. And dominance.
And dominance and control. And whether or not I'm going to fight it. So it really is teasing out. It's teasing out whether or not you're going to fight it or not. Yeah. Because not is accessible.
And it doesn't mean that you become a victim or you become vulnerable to it. It's just that you step outside of its field, kind of.
Absolutely. You shift yourself into a different vibrational state of being where I'm not willing to fight. I'm also not willing to be walked on, but that doesn't mean I'm going to fight.
And does it work?
Yes.
Does it work with people?
I watch it all the time. It's another way of saying it is showing up in a field of love, the absence of judgment, not requiring you to be any different than you are.
What if my intention is to hurt you?
I'll tell you a story.
Okay. I love stories.
When I was 24, it could be a long story, but I'll shorten it. When I was 24, I decided it would be really, really fun to drive semis and haul big loads.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I had an ad presented right in front of me, and I thought, wow, that looks like fun. I like big machines. Let's go. And so I went to this company, and they taught me to drive and ended up hauling tomatoes up and down the California Central Valley for a season.
Uh-huh.
Graveyard shift.
Uh-huh.
So here I am, 24 years old, female, out in the middle of nowhere on tomato fields with truck drivers and field workers and farmers, most of whom were male. And there were several times when I could just feel that, you know, some of these people were putting together some designs on what they were going to do with me or my physicality or whatever
right.
it was.
Yeah.
And I was watching this happen and sensing it happen, but in a place in myself where I just know that who I really am is a being of light, of love. And that can't be harmed. That's who I am. So they can't harm that. Whatever they choose to do, that cannot be harmed. It's just the truth. Their body could overpower my body. That's you know, conceivable. But if they want to do that, if that's what they really want to do, you know, do what you got to do. You can't hurt me. You're actually only going to be hurting yourself. And if I'm the one you're going to do those nasty things to, then it's going to be a gift for you because you'll have the opportunity to see who you really are. And
that's very centered and very courageous.
In that space, I'm walking around, do-do-do-do, enjoying myself, and a man starts walking toward me, and his face is kind of twisted. And I can just feel, and I can see his thoughts, and I can just watch multiple dimensions of what he's communicating through his presence and what he thinks is true for him in that moment. And he's walking toward me, and I recognize that he's got something shifty, and I just expand my space and be that space without judgment, saying, okay, well, do what you got to do, but I can see who you are, and you can't really harm me. And that space was just the truth. emanating outwardly from the core of my being. And within 12 or 8 feet of me, he gets closer to my physical presence. I just watched his face change. I watched everything about him shift and transform and change. His face relaxed. All of the harshness and strange thoughts just dissipated. And by the time he got up to me, it was like he couldn't remember where he just was a few moments ago. And he just sort of blinked his eyes and he looked at me and he said, "Do you have everything you need?" And I said, "Yeah, thank you." And he said, okay, good. Well, let me know if you need anything. And just sort of in a half of the daze, turned and walked away. So, does it work on people? Of course. Because we're all in communication at the level of presence, whether we're aware of it or not. The more we're aware of what we are communicating and where our motivation,
where the motivation
is from. Are we defending? Are we trying to run the show? Are we trying to control? Which is all good, you know.
As far as it goes.
Have a blast. Yeah, exactly, because it's just going to lead you down a certain path. And right. You'll get a chance to visit it again and see if that's how you want to do it again.
Mm.
But when we open our awareness, and it is courage to be vulnerable to our own thoughts and judgments and say, "Oh, gosh, it sure makes sense that I would have that list of judgments, but no thank you." Then we open ourselves to be in fluid communication with all that is, which is already happening, but
we're just not conscious of all of it.
Exactly. And when we take our awareness there, it does shift and change everything around us.
Beautiful. It's a really, you know, what I'm experiencing right now is a sense of intimacy with the creation that is both beautiful and full of a kind of tranquility, like a relief,
mm-hmm.
that I'm integrated with this whole thing. And I don't have to be so rigid about my boundaries.
Yes.
That I can flow, my consciousness can flow with a lot less judgment.
Yes.
And I think that feels really it feels really open and it feels receptive,
mm-hmm.
but not weak.
Absolutely.
And I think that I encourage everyone to try to have this feeling.
Because that's your natural state. That's who you are actually coming through.
Yeah, right. And that comes back to that one of the first quotes, an organic reality happens without trying.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's
nice.
That's the beginnings of what it feels like. And so show me more of that.
Okay. So, I want to ask you one last thing.
Okay.
And, you know, this has not been a typical Shamanic Life featured guest interview. I didn't ask you about how you got started. I didn't ask you any of that stuff. But this content has been so valuable and so precious that I'm extraordinarily happy with what we've covered. You talked briefly in your book, and I didn't get a chance to read it, about grounding and the challenge that you had in understanding why that was how people taught you how to ground. And I have a confession to make. I'm confessing on the air. I don't know how to ground. And I've been searching for, you know, all these tools that have been, you know, described to me. I try them and it's like, this doesn't make any sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that you have maybe a different insight.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. Cause it never made sense to me either. Cause it seemed like there was this list of things you had to do in order to qualify for being grounded. And it never made any sense to me either. Listening to people say, get in touch with this and visualize going up and then down and roots into the earth and all of that stuff. And to me, it's like, okay, but that's visualization and that gives me a certain sensation, but it still doesn't make sense to me. So what feels true to me is being a divine being, how about we instead call forth a greater congruency of that sense? Because we're here in a body on the planet. We're here in communication with the planet. Can we acknowledge the communication that's already there? Can we acknowledge the grounding or the steadiness of our connection with the planet that's already there, rather than giving ourselves a mandate to go somewhere to get it or alter our state somehow to get it? Instead, can we just call forth our natural state more and more and more, which is already completely in communion with the trees and the animals?
This sounds way better to me. All right. Oh yeah, that feels really solid. I could do that.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, don't get me wrong, not to deny or put down all of the teachings. They're magnificent because it's gotten everybody to where they are now. And awareness and consciousness is different now. There's more accessible to us because we are accessible to more with the way all of evolution is happening. So me, I'm a glutton for the fast track, and I just like, okay, show me that. Show me what that looks like to be already connected. Show me not just what it looks like, but what it feels like in the spaces between my cells, in the spaces between the particles of my cells, in the spaces between the particles of particles, to have the vibration of my own unique tone, my own divinity, be the resident and predominant vibration.
And what I'm drawing into that, in addition to that, is what does that feel like in relation to the Earth as the planet in which I live, in which my body is attached by gravity, and you know, all of that. It's like, oh, I'm here with this environment. If I can tune to the vibration that is that environment, which includes the massiveness of the Earth,
yes,
then I'm grounded. You know, that's how I connect to it. I don't connect to it with a grounding cord. I connect to it with a harmonic communion.
Yeah.
That.
Well, what I hear you describing is your awareness of this other living entity that is the planet and your openness to intimacy with it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That I don't have to change me, you don't have to change you, but we can both be here side by side, me and the planet. How awesome is that?
Exactly.
Because, I mean, am I divinity or am I divinity? Am I creator? And the planet is totally here to support me and my life and my enjoyment, because that just continues to fulfill the planet's evolution as a divine being as well. And in that dance, it just becomes a perpetual unfoldment of love in the absence of judgment. I'm me, you're you, let's dance.
This is awesome. I wish we could go on for another hour, but we're almost out of time. So,
oh, dang.
Is there any last thought you want to share with our listeners?
The last thoughts would be that every one of us has the accessibility and capacity to call forth that divine essence. And the body will communicate vibrationally its presence, our presence, so that truly the body then becomes an expression of that presence.
Mm.
Because it actually changes its shape and vibration to match the predominant vibration that we carry around. So when we're carrying stress or judgments of, you know, I did it wrong, or I was supposed to be this, or, you know, even unconscious things, the body can start to give symptoms that look like tension and disease. When we put our awareness and our priority on embodying that unique aspect and tone of divinity that I am and dissolve all else, another way to describe that, a word to describe that, is healing.
Mm, yeah.
And it's really just, I refuse to embody anything other than my own unique divine essence. Now show me what that looks like, and let all creation come from that place. And facilitating that is just the funnest, most awesome thing that I am here to share. just with the gifts that I have. You know, this is who I came here to be, and this is what it looks like right now. So who wants to play?
Yeah, that's great. So in a way, that's an example of describing who might want to come and see you.
Yeah, for sure. If this conversation sparks something that creates excitement, if you feel the vibration building in the solar plexus in the body anywhere, if it touches you and inspires you anywhere, then it would just be an honor to play and open up your world more and more and assist you to, you know, with a little basic tool set, but to empower you to flesh out your own tool set and create using your innate ability to just create more space for you to flourish and succeed, whatever that means for you. To me, it just looks like, how can I assist you to be more of you? And whether you're an artist, whether you're a therapist, whether you don't know what to call yourself, a lot of people that I play with, they have this sense that they know there's more and they don't know how to get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's fun. Because
you can help them get there.
Let's just eke that out and blow those doors wide open. Yeah, it just is so much fun. And whether it's with the animal kingdom, you know, people that live and work with animals and want to open that connection more, bring it on. Because one person expanding and opening into that space more creates exponential new space for thousands more to come along and remember their own sense. So, you know, if it's your business you want to open up, if it's your heart, if it whatever, I mean, that's getting into real specifics. It's who you are. And let's just blow your life stream wide open and give you tools and help you remember what true empowerment actually feels like on a sensory level, so that you can then be aware of, oh, wait a minute, I'm not feeling that. There's something going on that doesn't work for me. Okay, I've got a tool set. What do we do? How do we address this? And what is it that bring me the sensation of me again and show me what that looks like? What do I need to walk through? What do I need to look at? Because now maybe I'm starting to have the courage to look at it without judgment.
That's beautiful. That's really strong stuff. That's great medicine.
Thank you.
I'm back.
Yay!
I'm going to have you on another show. This is really cool. Okay, and so folks who want to get to know you or your work a little bit better, where do we direct them?
Yeah, thank you. I have my website, which is my name, Carrie Lake, carrielake.com, carrielake.com. And there's a contact us page there that also has my email and phone number if you'd like to just connect with me directly. There's a lot of writing. There's a blog and descriptions of how I work. And if any of it touches you and you just feel a sense of, I don't know, I want more of this, please connect with me and consider scheduling a one-on-one session, because that call is really your heart saying, okay, I'm ready to open. I'm ready for more. And I have the distinct honor of being an instrument that can assist.
That's wonderful. All right, Carrie, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
John, thank you. It's just amazing to get to share with you.
And we'll be back.
As promised, we're always thinking of ways to bring you a fresh new perspective. Check out this lineup of our newest shows. The Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, featuring Firefly Willow's LIVE favorite, Heisey Lutmers, and his co-host, Charlie Harrington, on the second Tuesday evening each month. A Shamanic Life, hosted by John Carosella, on the first and third Tuesday evenings each month. What's Your Prescription for Balance, with Mildred Lynn McDonald and her co-host, Dr. Glenna Calder, the first Thursday afternoon each month. And Evolve, with Robin White Turtle Lisney, the third Thursday afternoon each month. Introducing our newest show, the second and fourth Saturday mornings each month, From Beyond, with mother-daughter psychics Nadia Shapiro and Barbara Williams. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows, LIVE.
Welcome back. I'm John Carosella, and this is A Shamanic Life. Up next, Spirit, Muse, and Song. And my guest today is Sue Ellen Primost. Sue Ellen is a seasoned, classically trained cellist. She's a sound healer, ritualist, alchemist, storyteller, arts integration consultant, teacher, and recording artist. She's known for her soulful expressiveness and versatility across a wide variety of musical genres, including classical, jazz, improv, ambient, pop, folk, rock, Celtic, Eastern European, North Indian, and Turkish. I know you'll enjoy her work and our conversation. We're going to start with a piece called Cello by Moonlight. That was Cello by Moonlight by Sue Ellen Primost. And we are lucky to have Sue Ellen with us on the show tonight. Sue Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay, so when we talked, we were talking prior to the show, I got some new insight into the nature of that piece, Moonlight, Cello by Moonlight. I have to say, I was so enchanted by the intimacy of the cello, the way I could hear the wood in the cello in that piece. It was really powerful. Tell us a bit about your relationship to that piece.
Well, this piece I found in a stack of CDs that someone, I don't even know who it was, had left at my home. And one day I came upon it, and all that was on the CD was this particular track with the name Moonlight. And as I was listening to it, I was so moved and so aligned with the whole feeling of that, that I was inspired to create a cello track to integrate with the track that I was listening to. And that's how this particular Cello by Moonlight piece came to be.
So in a way, you have an intimate relationship with an anonymous composer.
That is correct.
And
yes.
And so it's like, you know, this feels to me like your muse jumping in and saying, Sue Ellen, there's magic here. Come and join this.
Precisely. I think you're exactly right about that. And I often feel this when I feel this attunement. I always start feeling cello tracks rising up in me. And so often I will go up to the musician if they're live and in person in the space I'm at and say, may I join you? May I join you and integrate a cello track into what you're doing?
And how is that received? When I think of cello, I think of a formal environment and a rather formal instrument.
Well, to me, it transcends all of the descriptions, all of the formality, because I've always improvised all my life, and the cello is a voice for myself that transcends words, that speaks from the deepest yearnings of my own heart and psyche and being. And it says so much more than words could ever say. So I've always sort of been out of this formal box with the cello. I don't even like to go there sometimes when it becomes work. And that's probably why I stepped out of working in proscenium situations with the cello. As much as I adore and cherish classical music, I feel there is so much more that can be expressed through improvisation and other particular genres of music.
So what is it like to do improv with a cello? I mean, you've studied the cello for a number of years, I guess.
I have.
Mm-hmm. So as with any instrument that you have long-term intimacy with, you develop a certain kind of mastery. So that your technical capacities, you've had plenty of time to develop those. But the muse part. Tell me about the voice of the cello and what it says and how it comes to you.
And the music is in dialogue. It's a character in the theater of life. It's responding to situations just as I am talking to you in this conversation, so the music does the same thing in this conversation. And it stays in relationship. It is honoring what is happening in the moment. It is responsive to that. It is picking up cues. It is driving a new direction. But you're together with whatever it is you are in dialogue with. You're together with that. So it's not going off on your own ego trip. It's not just playing notes. It has nothing to do with the notes. It has to do with what is between the notes. It has to do with that space, that beautiful space in a conversation where something else happens, and it's in that space that the muse enters and takes that conversation to a much higher place.
So that's interesting. You know, the space between the notes, Miles Davis has a famous quote that I'm fond of reciting. Is, it's not the notes you play, it's the notes you don't.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I wonder how lovers of Mozart feel about that kind of perspective.
Well, I'm going to put Mozart in a different category. I'm going to put Mozart in the category of genius. He was like Hokusai. He was like people who didn't have to say a lot, didn't have to fill a page with notes, even though many pages are filled with notes. They were the right notes. And it's like Hokusai who would say, I live for the day when I can say everything in one brushstroke. But the genius of Mozart is that he could create this amazing architecture level upon level upon level. And he did it perfectly. He had a perfect internal sense of that architecture. And the notes bring through all the power of that.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's how I would characterize Mozart.
I hope he's listening. I think he'd like that.
He probably is.
So you are classically trained?
I am classically trained.
But you don't play a lot of classical music anymore.
I still play classical music with friends, but I'm not playing in any orchestras these days.
And why is that? What changed?
Well, I love music too much. And what I mean by that is sometimes when you're in an orchestra, you get new repertoire every so many weeks. And it becomes almost like work. And I love music too much for that.
Hmm. Share a little bit about your spiritual path and your spiritual walk and how that informs your music.
Well, I think the first question it came up when I was about 10, and it came up with the question that we all ask at some point, which is, why am I here? How will I make my journey through life? What is the meaning of life? And that came up when I was 10. And that's when I started to study the cello. And I met along the way several teachers. The thing that came at that time when I was 10 was this phrase, red thread journey. And I use it because it's actually something that has been weaving through my whole life, informing my life, guiding my life, taking me to my people, to my tribe. It kind of connects people throughout my life. And this red thread started with that question, this red thread journey. It continued when I met my teacher from Yugoslavia, which was then Yugoslavia. Her name was Renata Skoberni. She was a concert violinist, a woman of tremendous knowledge. And when I was working with her, she said to me, and I had not mentioned this red thread journey ever to her, she said, you need to find the red thread in what it is you're playing.
Mm.
And the bell rang again in my heart. The next time that happened was when I came to Oakland, and I was taken into an amazing place, which was called the Art Ship. It was a 500-foot decommissioned Navy vessel, which was a floating arts commons. And when I came down into the hold of this ship, which had been turned into a theater, they're hanging from the very top all the way down to the theater space was an enormous fabric, a red thread.
Oh,
and again,
wow.
Again, my heart went ringing out of my chest. And this red thread, the last manifestation, the latest, was the creation, the midwifing of my album Shibui, Subtle Beauty, Soundtrack of a Life, which chronicles my red thread journey, which could be anyone's journey. It's a universal journey, but it has the particulars of my journey, and it chronicles those people, those places, that poetry, those images, those objects, all of those things that have informed my life. And it carried on through that. So the red thread has been very important in this.
Hmm. Wow. We don't often, I guess we often do, but we're not often aware of how the guideposts of our spiritual journey actually appear in our physical reality. And for you to have this red thread journey, this red thread motif so visible and present to your awareness, it must be comforting.
It's very comforting and very reassuring to get these. Yes, they are like reassurances along the path. And they also bring you in touch with people. I love this little line. This line, it says, there is an ancient Chinese belief that an invisible red thread connects those who are destined to meet, regardless of place, time, or circumstance. In pursuing the red thread, we feel connected to others and a sense of belonging to something far greater than ourselves. We are guided to meaningful service in the world, and we meet our tribes. So to me, this is the power, the potency of the red thread.
Mm. Wow, it's very beautiful. And you, your album, your CD, Shibui, I want to read an excerpt from a review of this CD. Shibui is the Japanese word for subtle beauty. And in this album, cellist Sue Ellen Primost, known for her intense melodic whine, has gathered musicians from a variety of traditions to produce a celebration of the inner life. The CD is a meditation cycle, an act of imagination that calls forth intensely visual images. It's the equivalent of a poetry reading, a tea ceremony, a Sufi dance, a moment of worship, and a lover's embrace as we move from one song to the next. That's fantastic. to bring that to your to life in music is such a gift for us. What was it like to produce Shibui, Subtle Beauty?
It came to me. I have to tell you how it came to me, which was a very beautiful moment. I woke up at 3 one morning, and all of a sudden I just was impelled to go and start gathering up all of these tiny objects I had on shrines around the room. This is very early in the morning, and I laid them on my sofa, and I placed a red scarf above them all. And then I realized what I was looking at was my whole life up to that point.
Mm, wow, yeah.
All the stations, you know, I was kind of rising above it and seeing it in a very mythic way. All the different stations, I had worked with the Hopi, so, you know, the representative objects, you know, the drum and the quill and the grandfather's picture and et cetera, and then the Sufi piece and all these different beautiful objects that were here in my home reminding me of things that I wanted to remember were laid out in front of me, and I just sensed the whole continuity, the continuity and the red thread weaving through each of them. Mm. And then what happened next was that poetry started to come to me, poetry that has informed my life. It started to match up and pair up with these vignettes. And then the next thing was the music that started to come through. So the album had nothing to do with, it was not a vanity album for the music. It was coming into that realization and also my act of reciprocity, that I was intensely grateful for all the gifts I had been given by having my life travel these paths, these ways, all the phenomenal people that I had met, and it was my way of giving that back. So that's what was behind the whole album of Shibui. And the production was just like a living meditation, bringing together musicians that I dearly love and respect. So that was the nature of the album and the intention.
Mm. And that it spontaneously emerged in a moment, right? You woke up at 3 a.m. and somehow the fruit was ripe and you responded.
Yes, I was allowed to be a midwife for this process. This was a baby that wanted to come through.
yeah, that's so beautiful. Wow. And I imagine you had some collaborators on this album?
Oh, I had the most remarkable collaborators, people that I have played with for many years, many of them, that have truly moved me and really influenced my whole way with music. So I brought together these people, and we would go into the studio, and it was almost, I think almost everything on that album was the first take.
Ooh.
And much of it was improvisation. Much of it was improvisation.
Wow. That's so beautiful. You know, when we were talking before the show, you talked a little bit about, actually a lot about your connection to the way of proceeding of Martin Buber, the Hasidic Jewish philosopher. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yes, I can.
And how that connects to the music.
Yeah, very much so. I grew up in a Jewish family, and when I was young, when I was 13, I was very interested in becoming a rabbi, but there was no such thing in my day of becoming a female rabbi. And later in my teens, I became rather disillusioned. I was Jewish for the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I think many Jewish people go through this one. I came to Washington, D.C. after college, and I met a man in an ecumenical church. He had been a scholar. He was still a scholar, actually. He grew up Jewish, but he had become Christian. And he said to me, "Would you like to do a program with me on Hasidism and Martin Buber?" And I said, "I don't really have any background on this." He said, "I'll work with you." So we worked together, and I learned so much. And it had such a deep impact and resonance with me. Martin Buber has written on this dialogue that happens in relationships. The dialogue takes place in a relationship that he calls I-Thou. It's an authentic dialogue, and it releases a tremendous healing potential when you recognize that spirit, that essence of spirit that has been placed in each person, each thing. When you recognize that, "I see the spirit of God in you," however it's said in any religion, it redeems that, it releases that spirit, and it flies back into wholeness again. There's also the I-it relationship, and that he speaks of as an objectifying relationship where you actually are in dialogue with an object. And when you're in that state, that objectification takes place actually in your mind. So you're really in a monologue.
Yeah, right.
And it's really just serving your self-interest. So this resonated so deeply with me, and it really guides my life. I mean, when I come into relationships, when I come into encounters with people, I want to be able to come into that space where I recognize that spirit in each person and am able to serve in the release of that has been scattered.
Mm.
And it has to come back into wholeness.
Yeah. And your music, you see your music as a another tool in that exercise.
Absolutely so, yeah. And the music, instead of words in that case, the music provides bridges of access for that dialogue to take place.
Mm, I love that. Okay, so on our way out today, we're going to close the show with a piece of music called Nida. Tell us a little bit about this piece and your collaborators on this piece.
the piece was written by a very remarkable musician, a man named Gary Hegedus, who is a multi-instrumentalist. He plays sarod, saz, oud, violin, mandocello, all kinds of Celtic instruments. And he is a man with no ego whatsoever, one of the most humble and spiritual people I've ever met and had the joy to play with. He is one of the performers, along with another gentleman called Imam. Imam was born in Persia. He studied North Indian classical music and has become a master percussionist. And only lately was I brought into this duo that they had formed. We call ourselves now the World Music Trio.
Mm-hmm.
And this piece, we played it live at our last performance. This one was, I believe, at Diana Center in Sebastopol. It's called Nida, and it starts with the cello. We've just come from an expository piece, A Dreamer, and it segues with this deep cello into the oud now, taking that and working itself into this piece that Gary wrote called Nida.
It's so deep and powerful. It's full of slow and powerful tones and phrases, but it's also got the rhythmic driving that is so potent, so energizing. I love it. So we're going to close the show with Nida, but before we do, Sue Ellen, if folks want to find out more about you and your work, where's the best place for us to direct them?
Well, one place they can go is to my music website, which is on Reverb Nation. They can just click on Reverb Nation and put my name in, Sue Ellen Primost.
Mm-hmm.
That's one place.
Okay.
I also have a Facebook page, and I also have a LinkedIn page. So if they just put my name, they Google my name, they will find me.
Okay. And that's Sue Ellen is one word, S-U-E-L-L-E-N, Sue Ellen.
That's right.
And your last name is Primost, P-R-I-M-O-S-T. So, and I encourage all of you out there, if you like this music, Sue Ellen is available for a lot of different things. And as you've heard, is great at improv and is a fantastic collaborator. So there's a lot of opportunity to draw this powerful and very, what's the word? Flexible? Live? I don't know. The work that you do with the cello is so interesting to me. I encourage everybody to check it out.
Thank you. Thank you, John, for your interest in this and allowing me to share these very deep things and meaningful things with a wider audience. And I wish blessings to everyone out there, and I hope that you will be inspired to follow your own red thread on this path to your own healing and return.
Thank you, Sue Ellen. And this is Nida by the World Music Trio. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you.
you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows, LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows, LIVE for Evolve with Robin White Turtle Lizney, Thursday afternoon at 2 p.m.